We are reading in Srimad Bhagavatam, the first canto, 15th chapter, the Pandavas retire timely. Text number 11. This is Arjuna's recollections. Continued. Translation. During our exile, Durvasa Muni, who eats with his 10,000 disciples, intrigued with our enemies to put us in dangerous trouble. At that time, he, Lord Krishna, simply by accepting the remnants of food, saved us. By his accepting food thus, the assembly of munis, while bathing in the river, felt sumptuously fed, and all the three worlds were also satisfied. Srila Prabhupada's purport. Durvasa Muni, a powerful mystic brahmana, determined to observe the principles of religion with great vows and under strict austerities. His name is associated with many historical events, and it appears that the great mystic could be both easily satisfied and easily annoyed, like Lord Shiva. When he was satisfied, he could do tremendous good to the servitor. But if he was dissatisfied, he could bring about the greatest calamity. Kumari Kunti, at her father, Kumari means unmarried girl. Kumari Kunti, at her father's house, used to minister all kinds of services to all great brahmanas, and being satisfied with her good reception, Durvasa Muni benedicted her with the power to call any demigod she desired. It is understood that he was a plenary incarnation of Lord Shiva, and thus he could be either easily satisfied or annoyed. He was a great devotee of Lord Shiva, and by Lord Shiva's order, he accepted the priesthood of King Shvetaketu because of the king's performance of sacrifice for 100 years. Sometimes he used to visit the parliamentary assembly of the heavenly kingdom of Indradev. I wonder if they really have a parliament there. Funny. He could travel in space by his great mystic powers, and it is understood that he traveled a great distance through space, even up to the Vaikuntha planets, beyond material space. He traveled all these long distances within 1 year during his quarrel with King Ambarish, the great devotee and emperor the world. He had about 10,000 disciples, and wherever he visited and became a guest of the great Kshatriya kings, he used to be accompanied by a number of followers. Once he visited the house of Duryodhana, the enemy cousin of Maharaj Yudhishthir. Duryodhana was intelligent enough to satisfy the brahmana by all means. And the great rishi wanted to give some benediction to Duryodhana. Duryodhana knew his mystic powers, and he knew also that the mystic brahmana, if dissatisfied, could cause some havoc. And thus he designed to engage the brahmana to show his wrath upon his enemy cousins, the Pandavas. When the rishi wanted to award some benediction to Duryodhana, the latter wished that he should visit the house of Maharaj Yudhishthir, who was the eldest and chief among all his cousins. But by his request, he would go to him after he had finished his meals with his queen Draupadi. Duryodhana knew that after Draupadi's dinner, it would be impossible for Maharaj Yudhishthira to receive such a large number of Brahmana guests, and thus the Rishi would be annoyed and would create some trouble for his cousin, Maharaj Yudhishthira. That was the plan of Duryodhana. Durvasa Muni agreed to this proposal, and he approached the king in exile according to the plan of Duryodhana after the king and Draupadi had finished their meals. On his arrival at the door of Maharaj Yudhishthira, he was at once well received, and the king requested him to finish his noontime religious rites in the river, for by that time the foodstuff would be prepared. Durvasa Muni, along with his large number of disciples, went to take a bath in the river. And Maharaj Yudhishthira was in great anxiety about the guests. As long as Draupadi had not taken her meals, food could be served to any number of guests, but the Rishi, by the plan of Duryodhana, reached there after Draupadi had finished her meals. When the devotees are put into difficulty, they have an opportunity to recollect the Lord with rapt attention. So Draupadi was thinking of Lord Krishna in that dangerous position, and the all-pervading Lord could at once know the dangerous position of his devotees. He therefore came there on the scene and asked Draupadi to give whatever food she might have in her stock. On her being so requested by the Lord, Draupadi was sorrowful, because the Supreme Lord asked her for some food and she was unable to supply it at that time. She said to the Lord that the mysterious dish, which she had received from the sun god, could supply any amount of food if she herself had not eaten. But on that day, she had already taken her meals, and thus they were in danger. By expressing her difficulties, she began to cry before the Lord, as only a woman would do in such a position. The Lord, however, asked Draupadi to bring up the cooking pots to see if there was any particle of foodstuff left. And on Draupadi's doing so, the Lord found some particle of vegetable sticking to the pot. The Lord at once picked it up and ate it. After doing so, the Lord asked Draupadi to call for her guests, the company of Durvasa. Bhima was sent to call them from the river. Bhima said, "Why are you delaying, sirs? Come on, the food is ready for you." But the Brahmanas, because of Lord Krishna's accepting a little particle of food, felt sumptuously fed even while they were in the water. They thought that since Maharaj Yudhishthira must have prepared many valuable dishes for them, and since they were not hungry and could not eat, the king would feel sorry. So it was better not to go there. Thus they decided to go away. This incident proves that the Lord is the greatest mystic, and therefore he's known as Yogeshwara. Another instruction is that every householder must offer food to the Lord, and the result will be that everyone, even a company of guests numbering 10,000, will be satisfied because of the Lord's being satisfied. That is the way of devotional service. So as Prabhupada did in the early volumes of Bhagavatam, first canto, he says Durvasa Muni in italics. It gives you a little history to tell about this famous character. So he explains this. He keeps showing up in the Mahabharata and other places, of course in Bhagavatam. Great austerities and penances. And therefore, because he was an expansion of Shiva, he has this characteristic. He very easily pleased, but irritable also. A little bit goes wrong, all hell breaks loose. Because when he's pleased, then there'll be a benediction. But when he's displeased, there'll be a curse. And his benedictions were powerful, and so were his curses. And so when he showed up at your doorstep, people were very careful. They know, you know, things can go this way or that way, depending on how he felt. So, of course, he's the one that's mentioned that when Kunti was a young girl, she received him very nicely, unmarried girl, Kanyakumari. She received him very nicely, and he was pleased with her. And so she got this benediction that she could call upon any demigod she desired. The idea was that she could have children by the demigods. Wasn't just so she decided to try it out, see what would happen. And she called upon the Lord of the Sun. He showed up, and she said, "Okay, thanks." He said, "Wait a minute, you know this." we can't call this off just yet. You know, I have to perform the reason you came. So she was like at that point very distressed. How can I have a child by you? You know, I'm not married or anything like that. So he arranged for a virgin birth. Karna was born out of the year. And then later on, when Pandu, her husband, could not have children, then she used this power to Yudhisthira, Arjuna, Bhima, in this way. So that was all because of Durvasa Muni's benediction. She could do that. And there were curses also. Of course, the one that's mentioned here is the one involving Ambarish. And again, it involves a minor breach of etiquette. Ambarish was in a dilemma. He had been fasting. Let's see, going into time. And it was time to break his fast. It was like a codicil, you know, you got a certain time you have to break your fast. And if people are strictly following the rituals, they're very particular about these technical details. And so Durvasa Muni came, and he had to break his fast. Maharaj Ambarish had to break his fast at a certain time. That was required. But the other requirement was it would be very rude to take anything before he served his guest. Well, Durvasa Muni was taking his bath. So Ambarish consulted with his advisors, what do I do in this dilemma? Damned if I do and damned if I don't. And, they suggested that he just sip some water. And that was sort of eating and not eating at the same time. So he did. But Durvasa Muni was greatly offended. He was in a rage that he didn't respectfully wait and serve his brahminical guest properly. And so he conjured up this demon to threw a hair on the ground, and this monster came out. And so anyway, that was the Durvasa Muni. So again, knowing all this about Durvasa Muni, this was the conspiracy that Duryodhana had pleased him. He asked Duryodhana what he wanted, and he said, "I want you to go visit my cousin Yudhisthira. They're living in the forest, the Pandavas, One thing is, don't show up until after they finished eating. Because as you see, from the sun god, Draupadi had received some kind of a dish or plate that would produce unlimited amounts of food stuff. It had this capacity. Whoever showed up, they could eat and just keep giving. But once she had taken, it had to recycle, you know. Shut down. So they wanted to make sure that Devasa showed up with his 10,000 disciples. They would have to feed them. And, you know, they're in the forest now in the jungle. They didn't have their palace and cooks and everything like that. But they would have to feed these 10,000 disciples. So if they showed up after Draupadi had eaten, the mystical plate would have been shut down temporarily till the time for the next meal. So that's what happened. Durvasa showed up. You can imagine their consternation. Here he is. So to play for a little time, you just say, you better go take your bath, you know, figure out what to do. So Draupadi was really very upset. They didn't know what to do because they knew all they needed was a curse from Durvasa Muni. If things weren't bad enough now ready, now they're going to get cursed by Durvasa Muni. And this was all Duryodhana's plan. This is, you know, send this, set them up for being cursed. So in this distress, she just didn't know what to do. Her plate simply wouldn't work. Because she'd eaten already. So here she started to think of Lord Krishna. This is the characteristic of devotees, that when they are in distress or danger, they think of Lord Krishna. And sometimes, as he says, with rapt attention, very attentively, because they have no other shelter. It is automatically they go to Krishna for shelter when in distress. And so Krishna showed up. And Draupadi just broke down in tears and said, you know, this is our difficulty. And so Krishna says, well, give me something to eat. And then she explains, you know, there's nothing left. I've already eaten and everything's gone. We have no provisions. I can't give you anything to eat. So he said, well, let's look and see. And then they found, you know, sticking to the edge of the plate, there's one little bit left. So he took it. And then suddenly, these 10,000 sages in Durvasa Muni bathing in the water, they all felt like they just had a huge feast. They couldn't eat a thing more. You know, they were filled up to here. So the Pandavas are waiting, and they're waiting and waiting, and the sages are staying in the river. So finally comes to see what's delayed, and they had decided to go. Because they were afraid of their causing an offense now if they showed up and couldn't eat. You know how you go to people's houses, they want you to eat, and they're offended if you don't. This is a big problem for the Brahminical class because sometimes traditionally the Brahmins have big bellies. It's an auspicious sign that the Brahmins are fat because they're being well fed, because it's their duty to eat on behalf of the Lord. So you have to eat. And so if you're visiting a lot of people, you have to eat 3, 4, 5, 6 times. It's a real art how to eat. I had this problem myself when I travel, especially to the Detroit temple. We have a lot of Indian people in our congregation, and some of them are initiated by me. And so the ladies, they want to come to dinner, several nights in a row. To go to somebody's house to eat. And so they make this huge feast, you know. The Gujarati people, you know, a big feast. And heavy, too. You know, the one thing that Gujarati people like, they just take, like, mango, that's been blended up, you know, so it's like thick mango pulp, which is a blender. And then they pour on top of it straight ghee. And then sprinkle it with ginger. It's really good, but man, is it? Anyway. So, you know, then they expect me to eat, you know, and I'm really past the age of great capacity eating. And so they're really disappointed if I don't eat very much. So finally, my solution was I'd take a brahmachari with me. So, hungry, you know, 19-year-old. And I said, this is my designated eater. And I would taste everything a little bit, you know, taste this, taste very good. And this person would eat for quantity, you know. And everybody was satisfied. It really worked. Anyway, so this is, you're expected to eat. So these sages knew that they were also, there would be a big insult to their guests, their hosts, if they didn't, eat. So they left. So here they're recounting. This is another big danger, that the Pandavas had faced. And again, Krishna, came and saved them. So Prabhupada says, when the devotees are put into difficulty, they have an opportunity to recollect the Lord with rapt attention. So actually the history of the Pandavas was a history of trouble. It's remarkable to think that here they were the special devotees of Krishna. They were very, very close to him. He, so much so that he acted like their family members. And yet you see what they went through. It was one thing after another. No end of trouble. And I remember Prabhupada saying in one lecture, talking about the Pandavas or Kunti Devi, saying, so you see, when you become a devotee, sometimes your suffering increases. I was a little taken aback. He said, they tell us chant and be happy, and now they say your suffering increases. What's this, like that? I didn't read the fine print, you know, on the contract. Your suffering increases. But that's, if you look back, actually in this, this canto, chapter 8, the prayers of Queen Kunti. And, she gives her, understanding, when she's praying to the Lord, she recollects all the sufferings that the Pandavas, she and her, the Pandavas had undergone. She begins like this. I'm starting on, this is chapter 8, text 23. She says, O Rishikesh, master of the senses and lord of all lords, you have released your mother, Devaki, who was long imprisoned and distressed by the envious King Kamsa. There's another group of people. Devaki. And me and my children from a series of constant dangers. My dear Krishna, your lordship has protected us from a poisoned cake, from a great fire, from cannibals, from the vicious assembly, from sufferings during our exile in the forest, of which one we're just hearing about the threat by Durvasa Muni, and from the battle where great generals fought. And now you have saved us from the weapon of Ashwatthama. He sent the, what you call Brahmastra, to destroy the embryo of Maharaj Parikshit. Prabhupada says, the list of dangers encountered is submitted herein. Devaki was once put into difficulty by her envious brother, Kamsa. Otherwise, she was well. But Kunti Devi and her sons were put into one difficulty after another for years and years together. So it was worse for them. Once Devaki had been imprisoned and Krishna escaped, and everything was all right. But the Pandavas, it just went on and on and on. They were put into trouble by Duryodhana and his party due to the kingdom, and each and every time the sons of Kunti were saved by the Lord. Once Bhima was administered poison in a cake, and once they were put into the house made of shellac and set afire. You know, by something that burns very easily. That was the arson. And they barely escaped because Vidura actually tipped them off what was happening, and they got out through a tunnel. And once Draupadi was dragged out and attempts were made to insult her by stripping her naked in the vicious assembly of the Kurus, the Lord saved Draupadi by supplying an immeasurable length of cloth, and Duryodhana's party failed to see her naked. Similarly, when they were exiled in the forest, Bhima had to fight with the man-eater demon, Hidimba Rakshasa. But the Lord saved him. So it was not finished there. After all these tribulations, there was the great battle of Kurukshetra, and Arjuna had to meet such great generals as Drona, Bhishma, and Karna, all powerful fighters. And at last, even when everything was done away with, there was the Brahmastra released by the son of Dronacharya to kill the child within the womb of Uttara. And so the Lord saved the only surviving descendant of the Kurus, Maharaj Parikshit. So that's a pretty nasty list. So you're thinking, why? Okay, the Lord protected them, but why did they have to go through this stuff to begin with? If he really protected them, wouldn't they just lead a nice life, you know? Not all these hassles, one after another. But here Kunti prays this famous verse, Vipada santuta shasvat tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam yasyat yatsyat apunar bhavadarshanam. I wish that all those calamities would happen again and again, so that we could see you again and again. For seeing you means that we will no longer see repeated births and deaths. That's her prayer. She uses this ending, santu and bhavatu. This is the, in Sanskrit, I think I mentioned this, they have special verb endings for benedictions, either giving a benediction or requesting a benediction. So it's saying, let us have the benediction of these calamities, the blessing of these calamities again and again. Let them happen again and again. Give us the blessings of these shasvat again and again, tatra, tatra. Because when these happens, we see you each time. Well, that's the tatra tatra, shasvat again and again, and then tatra tatra. Each time we see you, there is bhavata, darshan. There's your darshan, your seeing you. We get your darshan. Just like here, when Draupadi's breaking down in tears, wondering what to do, Krishna appears. And when we have your darshan, there's no more darshan of birth and death. This is the prayer of a devotee. So you can see that the sufferings or the calamities undergone by devotees are not really the same as those undergone by ordinary people, because they become impetuses for advancement in Krishna consciousness. This is automatic. Prabhupada mentions in the purport here, for ordinary pious person, when there's some calamity, they take shelter of Krishna. What speak for devotees when there's some threat or difficulty? Immediately they take shelter of Krishna. So sometimes this is, well, whatever it happens, for whatever reason Krishna wants, it happens. But this means that for a devotee, we have to see them, that here is Krishna in this form. Krishna has come to me in this form. I mean, look at the disaster of, even later on, Maharaj Pariksit. Here he was, a great king, really fixed up, running the kingdom nicely, and this ignorant, envious Brahmin boy curses him to die. So he sits down and decides, well, he's just going to prepare for death. Sages gather because he's the emperor of the world. This is a big thing. Then after a week, this thing shows up, this special effects Hollywood monster. The snake bird shows up and kills him. I mean, that's a bad story, right? That's not a happy ending, right? It's a calamity. Well, how did Maharaj Pariksit take it? It was a terrific opportunity. He could drop everything. He could sit down, prepare for death. Krishna reciprocated nicely to that surrender, sent Shukadeva Goswami to tell him Srimad Bhagavatam, and when the monster shows up, Maharaj Pariksit thinks, oh, he is coming to take me, welcomed him. So was it a disaster or wasn't it? So these are bad stories, but they're not. And here again, the Pandavas, they always had this special mercy of Krishna all the time. So the devotee takes these things in a different way, and Prabhupada discusses these. This verse he quotes many times. Which tells us how to deal with these things. Tate nukampam sushamikshamano bunjana ivatma kutam vipakam ridvag vapur pirdan namaste jivetayo muktipade sadaya bhak. This is Brahma praying. My dear Lord, one who earnestly waits for you to bestow your causeless mercy upon him, all the time patiently suffering the reactions of his past misdeeds and offering you respectful obeisances with his heart, words, and body, is surely eligible for liberation, for it has become his rightful claim. This word, Sadaya Bhak, is, it means that he has become the rightful heir. He's become the legitimate son. It means, it's a legal term actually, a Sanskrit legal term, to say that this is the person who can inherit the property, who's the legitimate heir. So, this one who does these things, he endures whatever suffering, thinks that, oh, this is a reaction for things done by myself. That these reactions are... let me read the purport here. Srila Sridhar Swami explains in his commentary that just as a legitimate son has to simply remain alive to gain an inheritance from his father, one who simply remains alive in Krishna consciousness, following the regulative principles of bhakti yoga, automatically becomes eligible to receive the mercy of the personality of Godhead. In other words, he will be promoted to the kingdom of God. The word susamikshamana indicates that a devotee earnestly awaits the mercy of the Supreme Lord, even while suffering the painful effects of previous sinful activities. Lord Krishna explains in the Bhagavad Gita that a devotee who fully surrenders unto him is no longer liable to suffer the reactions of his previous karma. However, because in his mind a devotee may still maintain the remnants of his previous sinful mentality, the Lord removes the last vestiges, vestige means a small trace, the last vestiges of the enjoying spirit by giving his devotee punishments that may sometimes resemble sinful reactions. You understand this is a nice point. Actually, it's not a sinful reaction, because actually the sinful reactions have stopped. Nevertheless, Krishna, to purify the devotee, clean out completely everything, will let these things happen so that the devotee can become purged. Purgation. Okay? Like Christians say, purgatory. Right? You burn away. The purpose of the entire creation of God is to rectify the living entity's tendency to enjoy without the Lord, and therefore the particular punishment given for a sinful activity is specifically designed to curtail the mentality that produced the activity. Although a devotee has surrendered to the Lord's devotional service, until he is completely perfect in Krishna consciousness, he may maintain a slight inclination to enjoy the false happiness of this world. The Lord therefore creates a particular situation to eradicate this remaining enjoying spirit. This unhappiness suffered by a sincere devotee is not technically a karmic reaction. It is rather the Lord's special mercy for inducing his devotee to completely let go of the material world and return home back to Godhead. So even though the devotee is thinking this is a token punishment, you may think like that, actually it's not. To go back to the Lord's abode. Therefore, he willingly accepts the Lord's merciful punishment and continues offering respects and obeisances to the Lord within his heart, words, and body. Such a bona fide servant of the Lord, considering all hardship a small price to pay for gaining the personal association of the Lord, certainly becomes a legitimate son of God, as indicated here by the words, Dayabak. Just as one cannot approach the sun without becoming fire, one cannot approach the supreme pure Lord Krishna without undergoing a rigid purificatory process, which may appear like suffering, but which is in fact a curative treatment administered by the personal hand of the Lord. So this is why we see, actually, you see in any all religious traditions, those who are saintly persons, they seem to undergo a lot of trouble. The whole history, martyrs, and one difficulty after another. It's always there. Why is that? It's a mercy. It's how people become purified. This means that there's ordinary suffering in the material world, which basically it's to no purpose. It's just suffering. Like animals suffer. You just suffer. I mean, there is a purpose, but it's long, very, very long term. But for a devotee, you may suffer, but it's to some purpose. It's not meaningless. Animal suffering. So it's designed to concentrate our attention, to keep us from thinking that the material world is a nice place or I might enjoy separately from Krishna. So in other words, the word austerity, tapasya, Sometimes it's translated just as suffering, but Prabhupada says it's the voluntary acceptance of suffering. Because when there is the voluntary acceptance of it, then one makes advancement. So if some suffering comes by its own accord, you didn't decide to do this. You didn't decide to start to take cold showers in the morning, but somebody forgot to heat the water. You say, oh, you have to, instead of getting angry at the guy, and I wonder why, here I've surrendered to Krishna, and now he's making me take cold showers. What kind of a God should give me hot showers, you know? No, Krishna will sometimes make these arrangements. So, and actually, if one accepts these things voluntarily, then advancement comes very nicely. And of course, when we make advancement, then actually we don't suffer. I mean, the suffering goes away. There's a difference, for example, between pain and suffering. Pain is a feeling that comes from our body, from the nervous system. Suffering is our reaction to it. The suffering comes because we identify with the body, and we think that this is happening to me. But if we're not identified with the body, it's not exactly that we've taken some painkillers, but we don't suffer. We don't suffer, and therefore pleasure and pain become the same. Krishna talks about this in the Bhagavad Gita a number of times. To a devotee, they become the same thing, because just as you may learn how to tolerate pain, also you have to learn how to tolerate pleasure. In neither case, there's not aversion to one or attraction to the other. And because of being absorbed in Krishna, it goes away. Everybody knows this. You can have some terrible headache or something, and suddenly you start, something interesting happens, and your attention is diverted to that thing. And then as soon as it stops, the headache is again there. But while you were interested, maybe the headache was there, but you just didn't notice. So if the rapt attention to Krishna is there, whatever's going on is not really bothering you. Attention to Krishna becomes more and more intense without any limit. Even on the highest platform, devotees seem to suffer. We have this other example also in this volume. Here's some suffering. Sri Krishna went with the gopis to the bank of the Jamuna, where the sand was cooling and the winds, enlivened by the river's waves, bore the fragrance of lotuses. There Krishna threw his arms around the gopis and embraced them. Now they are happy. Huh? He aroused Cupid in the beautiful young ladies of Braj by touching their hands, hair, thighs, belts, and breasts, by playfully scratching them with his fingernails, and also by joking with them, glancing at them, and laughing with them. In this way, the Lord enjoyed his pastimes. The gopis became proud of themselves for having received such special attention from Krishna, the Supreme Personality of Godhead, and each of them thought herself the best woman on earth. Lord Keshava, seeing the gopis too proud of their good fortune, wanted to relieve them of their pride and show them further mercy. Thus he immediately disappeared. That's what happened. Just when they were at their peak of happiness, he vanishes. It says here in the purport, The gopis were proud because they had attained as their lover the greatest of all personalities. So in a sense, they were proud of Krishna. Also, the pride of the gopis was a pretense created by Krishna's pastime potency in order to intensify their love for him through separation. In this connection, Srila Vishwanath Chakravarti quotes Bharata Muni's Natya Shastra. You know, the Natya Shastras are the rules for drama. Natya means a dramatic performance. So all the rules are there. Direct connection is not fully appreciated until separation has been experienced. That's why you have the standard plot. Boy meets girl. Boy loses girl. Boy gets girl again. That's the basic plot, right? Why you have to have this plot? Because the reunion is more intense after the meeting. So it's right there in the, you know, I don't think Hollywood has ever read Bharata Muni, but it's recognized by everybody. So therefore, actually Krishna is aiming at intensifying love. And so he uses separation. It looks like suffering. But on the spiritual level, that is, it's another form of ecstasy. So he disappeared, in order to, it says, diminish their pride. The purport says, Lord Krishna was not going to neglect the gopis, rather he would increase the power of their loving affairs by making another spectacular arrangement. So the other spectacular arrangement, then of course Krishna disappears, and the gopis go crazy. I mean, they are in such a disturbed condition of mind. They're not in their right minds. And they're falling around looking for Krishna, looking at his footprints, and then they can see one gopi's with him by the footprints, and by sort of following the trail they can see where something was going on with this gopi. Right? And this, of course, is Radharani. And then Krishna pulls the same stunt on her. He disappears. And then, of course, there's a reunion, at which there's a big argument, really, because the gopis are why have you done this to us? You know, there's a whole discussion. What went on and why did you do this? And they had a little reconciliation because they're angry. You know, they're really... And he has to pacify them and make everything all right again. So this is another case of what looks like suffering. So you see it all the time. Another interesting one is when Krishna jumped, you know, the snake Kalyanaga had taken the shelter in a big pool or lake in the Jamuna River, and he's so poisonous that there was a like a big toxic waste dump. And, you know, animals, it was an ecological disaster for Vrindavan, this snake. And so Krishna jumped in the river, to fight him. Just a little kid, you know, and on the banks of the rivers, cows look like they're dead, and cowherd boys look like they're dead. So the word went out to the inhabitants of Vrindavan that he was in the river with Kalyanaga. Everybody came running to see what was going to happen. His mother, his father, and everything. And then what happened was very interesting, that what they saw was that instead of immediately being victorious over Kaliya, Krishna rather let himself be wrapped in the coils of the snake, like he was in bondage, and stayed there for several hours. And the at that time, there were many inauspicious signs like earthquakes and thunder and lightning and deities falling off of the altars and things like that. And the inhabitants of Vrindavan were in total anguish. And Mother Yashoda was almost on the point of death. And then Krishna broke loose and began dancing on his heads. You know. So why did he do this? Because he increased their attachment to him. He increased their love for him by this tactic. And the whole scene, actually, what this whole thing reminds me of is the whole story of the crucifixion of Jesus. You know, it's the same mood. Why did he do this? He's being crucified. Looks like he's being grasped by death, you know. His disciples are completely in anguish and freaking out. There's bad, inauspicious omens. And then later, it turns out he's fine, you know, no problem. So why this? Yeah. So it increases the love, increases the attachment. So sometimes people need to go through this to increase their attachment. And because their love increases, they see all these things as a benediction. More and more their love increases, and more people like Kunti pray, bring it on, let it happen again and again. So it's like this is the way Krishna works, and the devotees become purified. You may get proud, you know. We know in the Hare Krishna movement, we have a mission somehow or other. We're serving Lord Chaitanya's mission. We are God's chosen people, you know. Every so often in history, for reasons we don't know, God chooses some people to enact His will in the world. And usually the people He picks, for whatever reason, they're not very perfect. They've got problems. Some, but for whatever reason, He picks them. And you know you're picked. You've gotten sufficient information. We all think that, you know, ISKCON has a mission to save the world and we can do all these things. We know we're chosen somehow or other. We think we're not deserve it. We know that. But still, you know. So you have groups that have that strong sense of themselves. The Jews had that sense of themselves. The Puritans, the elect, they called themselves the elect. You know, the Calvinist Puritans. They're going to go out and save the world. So you see very typically that those that are chosen by God then suffer like hell. That's why actually people like to avoid devotional service sometimes. Because they're a little afraid of the whole thing. You know? Because then you go through so much tribulation. But Krishna does this. So these people, they know they're chosen, but they're going to be my instruments now. I have to perfect them so that they do what they want, so they become closer to me. So they don't become proud and so on. So we have to learn how to welcome whatever comes from Krishna and understand it's coming from Krishna. And we have to say, even Prabhupada said, you know, he remarked at one time that after he had left his family life and gone to Vrindavan to become, you know, increase his dedication, he was, I think he was gored by a bull in Vrindavan. And he was, you know, here I come to this place, I surrendered everything, and now this happens. And somehow or other, Prabhupada managed to crawl back to his room and recover, you know, all by himself, no money, anything like that. So Prabhupada remarked that he said, I accepted it as Krishna's mercy. And he said, and later I understood how it was Krishna's mercy. So the implication that he's saying is that at the beginning, you may not understand how this is Krishna's mercy, but still you should accept this is Krishna's mercy. And then later, Maybe a Christian will let you understand why this and not that, why this happened and not that happened. So it's like if we want to make an advancement in Krishna consciousness, we can discover that we will develop a taste for austerity. Say we undergo some voluntary difficulty. We notice when we go to this voluntary difficulty, there's some physical unpleasantness involved, some difficulty, too hot, too cold, something. The food's not good, and you know, I have to. My senses, in some ways, are not pleased. But by undertaking this difficulty, I make spiritual advancement. That spiritual advancement is so relishable, and I associate that increase of spiritual advancement with the physical austerity. And then I start to like physical austerity. It becomes attractive. And similarly, sense gratification, I'm offered some opportunity for sense gratification, and if I enjoy it, then I notice my Krishna consciousness decreases. And I actually, this sense gratification makes me feel worse. So what looks like nice to people in the world starts to look to a devotee, and not just look, not just theory, feels that this is not relishable at all. And what looks bad to the world, to a devotee, looks great. So therefore they think we're crazy, and we think they're crazy. As pointed out in the Bhagavad Gita, what is night for one is day for the other, and vice versa. This change happens. So that's why Krishna acts this way for the devotee. And we have to have the confidence that he knows what is best for me. He's giving the best thing for me. And I have to rise to the occasion, as they say, and actually embrace this difficulty and say, what is there in this situation that is for me to do so I can increase my surrender to Krishna? We just look for that. What is there in this situation that will enable me to increase my devotional surrender to Krishna? If we have that attitude, then Krishna will show us and we'll advance. But we'll be stuck if we say, why is Krishna doing this to me? I'm his devotee. I've been serving for so many years, and now this, what's he up to? Maybe there is no God. Something like that. So we have to have the right attitude toward this, as instructed here.